History at Hand, revision at your fingertips. This is the first of two podcasts focusing on the origins of the Second World War. This one focuses on the key events that took place between Hitler's accession of power in January 1933 and the outbreak of war in September 1939. The second podcast focuses on the issue of appeasement, whether or not it was the right or wrong policy, and how it was abandoned in 1939. In order to understand what Hitler was aiming for, we have to think about his foreign policy aims. They were written down in 1924 in his book Mein Kampf and were repeated often in Hitler's speeches and deliberations. At the heart of the policy was a reversal of the Treaty of Versailles. Hitler believed that Germany had a superior place amongst nations and that it should be entitled to dominate the continent of Europe. Hitler demanded that Germany be allowed to rearm, that Germany should recover the territories lost in 1919, and that all Germans should live within the German Reich. He also believed in Lebensraum, that Germany deserved and were entitled to more territory in the East. Hitler was also violently anti-communist and violently anti-Semitic. These also flavored his foreign policy aims. In order to achieve his goals, Hitler would need to build up a strong army. He would also need to gain allies and limit the potential hostility from countries like Britain and France. Hitler set Germany on a task of avenging the Treaty of Versailles, and he steered the world again onto the path of war. Hitler withdrew from the League of Nations and the Disarmament Conference in 1933. This he could justify, as he claimed that other countries hadn't kept their commitment to disarm after World War I. He then started rearming in secret, especially with his air force. By 1935, Hitler was confident enough to go public with his rearmament proposals, and even introduce conscription to build up the size of the German army. This was clearly a violation of the Treaty of Versailles, yet the international response was ambiguous. In some respects, Britain, France and Italy showed concern. They joined together in what was called the Stresa Pact. But, at the same time, Britain signed a naval agreement with the Germans, allowing them to build up 35% of the British surface fleet. Here we're seeing, with such confusion, the Germans were easily able to exploit the differences of others. In January 1935, Hitler achieved his first success in restoring German territory to his Reich. The Saarland had been under League of Nations control since the Treaty of Versailles. A plebiscite was to be held 15 years later in order to determine whether or not it should remain a League of Nations territory, or become part of France, or become part of Germany. 90% of the population voted for reunification with the Reich. It was a clear victory for Hitler, though it would have probably happened even without him. A much more significant move by Hitler came on the 7th of March 1936. On that day, a small unit of the German army marched into the demilitarized zone of the Rhineland. This was expressly against the terms of the Treaty of Versailles and the subsequent Locarno Pacts of 1925. The move was greeted with great popular acclaim across Germany. Here was a clear aggressive move, and maybe the international community should have done something about it at this stage. So why didn't they? France was unwilling to act without Britain's support, and besides, their government was very weak at the time. The British considered the Rhineland to be a part of Germany, and therefore Hitler hadn't really done anything wrong. He was merely walking into his own backyard. Hitler himself claimed that this was the biggest gamble of his career. Had the British or French reacted strongly, then he would have been forced to withdraw his troops. This was a clear success for Hitler, an opportunity where he could have been stopped. Britain and France, too busy coping with the Abyssinian issue, were distracted and weak at a time when strength could have been more beneficial. In 1936 and 1937, Hitler consolidated his international position. He came to agreements with the Italians and the Japanese, creating what's known as the Axis. He also was able to successfully exploit the Spanish Civil War for training for his military, particularly his air force. His next big move, though, came in March 1938, the Anschluss with Austria. Austria had been forbidden from uniting with the Germans by the treaties of Versailles and Saint-Germain. Austria was a German-speaking nation, and many of its inhabitants, like Hitler himself, wanted Germany and Austria to be united. Remember, it was where Hitler was born. In 1934, there was an attempt by Austrian Nazis to take over the government. They killed the Chancellor Dollfuss, but they were thwarted by the new Chancellor Schuschnigg and the Italians siding with the new Chancellor. As a result of that, Austria remained an independent country. Hitler wasn't strong enough at that stage to do anything about it. By 1938, though, things had changed. The Italians were now on Germany's side. That meant it would be very hard for anyone in the international community to actually challenge the Nazis militarily if they were going to take Austria. Austrian Nazis were agitating for union. The Chancellor Schuschnigg was summoned to see Hitler in February 1938. There, Hitler demanded that Austria should pave the way to become part of Germany, and that the leader of the Austrian Nazis, Seyss Inquart, would be able to have a government position in charge of the police and security. Schuschnigg responded to the challenge by organising a plebiscite. This plebiscite asked the Austrian people if they wanted a free and Germanic, an independent and social, a Christian and united Austria. It was the sort of question to which you would obviously answer yes. Hitler was furious, as he saw this as a means by which Austria would maintain its independence. He threatened Schuschnigg with German invasion of Austria, unless he resigned and the plebiscite was called off. Schuschnigg then did resign, along with the rest of his government, except for Seyss Inquart, the Nazi leader. He then invited Adolf Hitler and his troops to come into Austria. Hitler was greeted very enthusiastically on the road to Vienna. There he declared Austria to be a part of the German Reich. Again, the international community didn't really do anything. This was the will of the German and Austrian people, and what could they possibly do to stop it? It did make Hitler more powerful, though. He now had millions more men, he had many more resources under his disposal. Hitler's taking over of Austria resulted in 80,000 political opponents being arrested, and also the Jews, 200,000 strong in Austria, being forced to think about their future as their civil rights were taken away from them and they were persecuted on the streets. The takeover of Austria now left Czechoslovakia very vulnerable to German attack. Silesia to the north, Austria to the south, were like jaws pressing down on Czechoslovakian territory. This was made even worse by the fact that millions of Germans, 3.5 million in fact, lived within Czechoslovakia and were determined to become part of the Reich too. After the Anschluss, agitation from the Sudetenland, orchestrated by the local Nazis led by Konrad Henlein, made the situation for the Czech government almost desperate. Hitler kept making more and more demands, and the British were determined that this shouldn't have to lead to war. By September 1939, it looked like Germany was on the brink of invasion, citing abuses by the Czech on the minority German population. Neville Chamberlain took the unprecedented step of flying to Germany 3 times in September 1938 in order to come to a peaceful settlement to this problem. After his first meeting with Hitler at Berchtesgaden, it seemed like an agreement had been made. When he flew back to confirm things at Godesberg, Hitler had increased his demands, and for a week or so, it seemed like Europe was on the brink of war. Then, Mussolini proposed a meeting of the four powers, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy, to be held in Munich. It was at this conference that the Sudetenland was prized away from Czechoslovakia. Neville Chamberlain also got an Anglo-German agreement. Hitler in this promised that he would not use aggression again in order to satisfy Germany's needs. He would use diplomacy and negotiation instead. The public across Europe greeted the Munich Agreement with a sense of relief. Others, though, were critical. Here again, Hitler had threatened war and been able to get land for Germany. What was to stop him doing it again? Less than 6 months later, Hitler occupies Bohemia and Moravia, what was left of Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia was in a state of internal collapse. The Czech president Hacha turned to Hitler for help. Hitler bullied Hacha into accepting an occupation of Czechoslovakia by the German army, and on the 15th of March 1939, German tanks and German troops rolled and marched onto the streets of Prague. This time, it was no liberation of German peoples from foreign rule. It was no reversal of Versailles. This was seen as naked aggression. This signalled a fundamental change in policy from Britain. No longer would they appease Hitler, now was the time for confrontation. Hitler went on to take Memel from Lithuania too, and Britain saw that it was now time to act more decisively. Looking at the map, it was clear that Hitler's next target would be Poland. Britain made a stand. They were determined to ensure that Poland would be defended should it come to war against Germany. On the 31st of March, Britain and Poland signed a treaty of mutual guarantee. That meant that Britain would defend Poland in the event of an invasion by Germany. Hitler believed that the British were just bluffing and that they wouldn't actually stick up with this agreement. But Britain now felt more militarily confident of what it could do if it came to war, and also British public opinion and Chamberlain's own perception of Hitler had fundamentally changed since the Munich Agreement was made a mere 6 months earlier. During the summer of 1939, both sides were gearing themselves up more for war. Germany and Italy together signed the Pact of Steel. The Italians invaded Albania. It made everyone much readier for the eventuality of war coming. The one piece of the jigsaw still missing when it came to taking sides was Russia, the Soviet Union. The British public were very keen to see Britain sign an alliance with the Soviet Union. They were a big, strong country with a large army who could potentially resist German aggression in the east. Chamberlain, though, was more reluctant. He mistrusted the Russians. He didn't like communism, and he felt they weren't as strong militarily as they made themselves out to be. Negotiations dragged on, but without any real sense of purpose. Stalin, the Soviet leader, mistrusted Chamberlain and thought he would seek to appease again, as he had done at Munich, where Stalin wasn't invited. For the British, the big concern was having Soviet troops on Polish soil. Having made a guarantee to Poland, Britain's commitment to them could not be overridden. On the 23rd of August 1939, the world was shocked to hear that the Nazi-Soviet pact had been signed. The foreign ministers of Germany and Russia, von Ribbentrop and Molotov, had signed a pact which, on the surface, was to guarantee neutrality in the event of a war with a third country. In secret, though, it agreed to carve Poland up between the two of them. Germany for the West, Russia for the East. This came as such a shock because it was perceived that the Nazis and the Communists were so ideologically opposed to each other that they could not possibly get on any circumstances. But this agreement was made because both could offer something to the other which an agreement with Britain could not. That is the prize of Polish territory. The Nazi-Soviet pact was greeted in Britain with dismay, but also with resolve. Britain reinforced its commitment to Poland, in spite of the fact that now Hitler was gearing towards war. Hitler increased his demands for Danzig, the League of Nations city, to be returned to the Reich, and also for the Polish corridor to become German. Again, he cited atrocities being carried out against the German populations. On the 1st of September 1939, he decided to invade Poland. He believed that Britain and France would again try and worm their way out of their commitments. Britain sent a final ultimatum to Hitler to get him to withdraw his troops. When this failed, Britain declared war on Germany at 11 o'clock on the 3rd of September 1939. The French followed 2 days later. The world had again embarked on a catastrophic war. As we have seen, this was Hitler's war. He embarked on a series of foreign policy adventures and used aggression in order to improve Germany's position in Europe. To start with, his ambitions were reasonable and within revising the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. What we see developing is that Hitler becomes more and more ambitious as time goes on, wishing to gain Lebensraum in Eastern Europe. And it is this that finally pushes the Western democracies, Britain and France, to declaring war against Hitler in 1939. In the examination, you may be asked questions where you have to describe one of these stages towards the war, maybe on the Rhineland or the Anschluss. Other times, you will be asked to analyse sources regarding this, particularly photographs of Hitler or marching German troops, or cartoons showing British reaction to this. Essay questions will ask you to weigh up two circumstances, two events, and how important they were in the lead up to war, or why they are considered significant, or why Hitler wasn't stopped. A knowledge of the chronology and background understanding is vital if you are going to achieve on these particular parts of the exam. Goodbye and good luck.